Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Your workplace is sexist, even if it's not visible, even if you work for yourself. That's the launching point for KUOW's new podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. And you'll meet the hosts in just a few minutes. I hope you can stay with us. First, our top story today. Local groups are rallying this afternoon at Seattle's federal courthouse after the U.S. Supreme Court today upheld President Trump's latest travel ban. Here is what President Trump said about his victory this morning at the White House.
This is a great victory for our Constitution. We have to be tough, and we have to be safe, and we have to be secure. At a minimum, we have to make sure that we vet people coming into the country. We know who's coming in. We know where they're coming from. We just have to know who's coming here.
We have to vet who's coming here. Let's learn more about today's ruling with Associated Press reporter Mark Sherman. He covers the Supreme Court. Welcome, Mark.
It's good to be with you.
Thanks for your time. The U.S. Supreme Court today reversed a series of lower court decisions regarding travel bans. What changed?
Well, what changed is there are five conservative justices on the Supreme Court who sided with the administration, and they signaled as much, frankly, in December when they allowed that ban to take full effect, even after courts in Hawaii and Maryland and then the Ninth Circuit and then the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia had blocked it.
Did the Supreme Court majority today describe how they thought the lower courts got it wrong?
Yes, they did. The court said that basically the president has considerable authority in the area of immigration and considerable authority when he's acting, to keep the country safe, that both of these things are present in the travel ban policy. And as far as the immigration law is concerned, the president has the authority to do what he did. And they also rejected a claim that the ban discriminates against Muslims.
Okay, there's a few things there. You described considerable authority placed in the executive branch over immigration, but also keeping the country safe. How did the Trump administration demonstrate that the travel ban is necessary or important for keeping the country safe?
Well, that's a sort of part and parcel of immigration law. I mean, one of the reasons the president has significant authority over immigration law is a national security interest, who can come into this country. And so that goes hand in hand with the immigration law. The administration, says it vetted these countries. I mean, we talked about vetting the people who are coming, but it first vetted the countries and identified some with shortcomings in the way either they share information or in the way they produce their own documents that allow their own people to travel. And the administration says it acted and came up with a list of countries based on the results of its review. Now, the court didn't really look behind that. It didn't really examine much of what the administration did. It did accept what the administration said about what it found when it looked at countries around the world.
Okay, so inadequate vetting. It wasn't that the Supreme Court majority agreed that immigrants from these countries pose a national security risk?
No, it did not say that at all. In fact, the majority did say, and at least in one place in the opinion, the Chief Justice wrote, "We express no view on the soundness of the policy."
Okay. And what about the question of a motivation by religious bigotry? What did the majority, U.S. Supreme Court majority, say about that, if anything?
Well, again, it found that the claims were not justified. They could not overcome this strong presumption that you have in favor of allowing the president to institute this policy. It said that there are all kinds of reasons that it didn't necessarily endorse at all any of the statements that the president has made and that were cited by the challengers, everything from his campaign pledge to shut down Muslim entry into the United States to some of the more recent things he's done on Twitter, including retweeting some provocative videos from Europe. It didn't endorse any of that. It did, however, say that there were lots of countervailing interests, including the fact that if this was in fact a Muslim ban, it was an ineffective Muslim ban because it points out that the policy covers just 8% of the world's Muslim population. It's also limited to countries that Congress had previously designated as posing security risks. So it's not a willy-nilly policy that merely seeks to ban Muslims. That's what the Supreme Court majority said. Now, of course, the dissent saw it very differently. Justice Sotomayor, in a very powerful dissent, wrote that the decision, you know, was similar to the Korematsu decision, widely discredited from World War II, that justified the internment of Japanese Americans.
And interesting, you bring that up. Chief Justice Roberts overruled. I mean, that he went out of his way to overrule that Korematsu decision from 1944 that allowed for the detention of Japanese Americans in camps, and Roberts wrote that forcibly relocating U.S. citizens solely and explicitly based on race is outside a president's authority. What was your reaction to that?
Well, there's a bit of a debate about whether the court actually formally overruled Korematsu.
I looked around for that wording in other sources, and I wonder what is the power of that statement from Roberts?
It's a powerful statement. Whether it actually has the force of law is a matter of debate, but it's almost irrelevant to the current situation. I mean, what Robert said was that Korematsu was gravely wrong the day it was decided, has been overruled in the court of history, and to be clear, has no place in law under the Constitution. But there wasn't an issue in this case, obviously, and so you could conclude that there's no holding of the court that actually overrules Korematsu today.
Okay. Why do you think Justice Roberts took that step to write that?
Well, I think he was responding, frankly, to the dissent here, and it was a brief but sort of powerful couple of paragraphs in his own opinion that says, in essence, don't be ridiculous. This is nothing like Korematsu. He said Korematsu has nothing to do with this case. He said that the dissent was employing Korematsu for its own rhetorical advantage in its arguments.
Now, you heard President Trump say a few minutes ago that we need to vet the people coming here. But the Chief Justice wrote today that the president has the power to prevent, as you said, entry of nationals who cannot be adequately vetted. So which is it? Do you have signs that the Trump administration is going to change the way it, quote unquote, vets people coming from other countries?
So today's ruling does not affect the state of play in the sense that the ban itself has been fully in effect since December. So it's already in effect. It will not cause the government to change the way it does business. It's merely making it nearly impossible for people from those countries to come here. But according to the administration, and also as referenced in Roberts' opinion, not impossible, because there's a waiver program which allows people from these countries to still seek visas. And the administration says that more than 800 people have gotten these visas since the ban took effect, although we have no sense of how many people have sought them.
We're talking with Mark Sherman, who's an Associated Press reporter covering the U.S. Supreme Court, which today upheld President Trump's travel ban. What's a final observation from you on this, Mark? What surprised you? What did we learn today?
So I don't think the decision was surprising in the sense that, as I said earlier, I think the court signaled the eventual outcome when, even as the case was proceeding in December, and even after lower courts had found problems with the policy, that it allowed the full policy to take effect. That's often a signal that the court will eventually, you know, uphold the policy at issue. So I don't think it was necessarily a surprise about how today came out. What this decision sort of suggests, apart from the decision itself, is that there is a robust conservative majority on the court, contributed to by Trump's nomination and the Senate's eventual confirmation of Neil Gorsuch, sort of restored the balance of power that existed before Justice Scalia died back in 2016, and that President Obama and Senate Democrats had hoped to reverse when Obama nominated Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court.
But I don't hear you saying that this ruling gives the president new powers over immigration today.
Well, I don't think it gives him new powers. I think it confirms that the president has very significant power over immigration.
Okay.
And President Trump attempts to use that going forward, we'll see. But he hasn't been shy about using his power over immigration until now.
Yes, we'll see what's next, and we're going to talk about that right now. Associated Press reporter Mark Sherman covering the Supreme Court. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
So this Supreme Court decision upholds the travel ban on immigrants from Iran, North Korea, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and Venezuela. And here to react to the ruling and let's talk about what's next is we have Tom Ikeda, who's the executive director at Densho. It's a Seattle nonprofit dedicated to preserving the stories of Japanese Americans incarcerated during World War II. We were just talking about the Korematsu decision. Welcome back, Tom.
Thank you, Bill.
Also with us is Sahar Fathi, who's board president with One America Votes, working to empower immigrant and refugee communities through participation in the democratic process. Sahar, nice to see you. Thank you. Your reaction to the ruling, Tom, we discussed, you were here a year and a half ago with me talking about the Japanese-American internment and connections to today. What was your reaction to today's ruling and the Chief Justice's references to the Korematsu 1944 ruling?
Yeah, Bill, last time I was here, we talked, I think I mentioned that I was kind of on this roller coaster of fear and hope.
Yes.
And right before this ruling, I actually had a lot of hope because, you know, contrary to what Chief Justice Roberts believes, I really do think there are strong similarities to what happened to Japanese Americans and how the Supreme Court ruled during World War II and their ruling to today. So let me explain that a little bit. I mean, you know, Chief Justice Roberts was actually trying to distance today's ruling from Korematsu. And, you know, he said that, you know, Korematsu was gravely wrong the day it was decided and has no place in law under the Constitution. And what we have to recognize is that this is all in hindsight, that, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, you know, stated, you know, the forcible relocation of U.S. citizens to concentration camps solely and explicitly on the basis of race is objectively unlawful and outside the scope of presidential authority. But during World War II, when the Supreme Court ruled, you know, against Korematsu and you know, confirmed the you know, the detention of Japanese Americans, they weren't doing that based on race. They were basing it on military necessity. They had this thinly veiled facade, essentially, that said, you know, these people are dangerous. You know, there's a possible military invasion. We think there are spies. All these were. You know, half-truths and lies by the government to veil what they really was happening, that the prejudice and the animus against Japanese and Japanese Americans.
And you're saying you see that today, the half-truths and lies?
Exactly. So
what's an example?
Well, so, you know, during the election, the campaign, and even currently, we hear over and over again from President Trump and his administration, you know, his animus, his prejudice against Muslims. And, you know, we had the first Muslim ban that was stricken down because it was so blatantly prejudiced against Muslims. And so we have this you know, when you're a victim of prejudice, you could just sense it. You know when this is happening. But then they finally, you know, what he said, got it right by now having this new order that says, well, it's not really about Muslims. It's about military or it's about national security. And we have to tighten up our immigration. And that's what we're all about. But I think we all know that it's really about, you know, his prejudice against Muslims and what he's trying to do. And that's what happened during World War II. Again, they talked about over and over again, you know, we had politicians, the media saying, oh, you know, Japanese are they're like infesting the country, they're horrible, we have to get rid of them, on and on. But the actual order for Japanese Americans was, oh, it's really a military necessity. And that's what the ruling was. And that's what the Supreme Court ruled in 1944, and that's what they rule today. So there are similarities, and yet what the strange thing was, when Chief Justice Roberts essentially repudiated Korematsu, he clearly said, we were wrong back in World War II. But again, he's using the hindsight of history to be able to say that.
Sahar Fathy, what was your reaction to today's Supreme Court ruling?
You know, I really appreciate that roller coaster analogy. I think at first, and I, you know, I still sort of feel really sad about all of it. I took it personally a little bit, and I, you know, I'm a lawyer. I believe in the justice system. I believe in the legal system.
What do you mean you took it personally?
Well, I'm an Iranian. I'm a dual citizen. I'm Muslim. Like, the to me, it felt like somebody very specifically who has a lot of power didn't like me and my people and came out with these policies, and everyone sort of but the majority of the people on the court sort of said, well, we're going to look past that and we're going to rule this way. And I kind of wanted to go back and say, what do you mean you're going to look past that? Like, you need to see me and you need to see my people, and that this is clearly like a blatant discrimination against where people come from and how they pray, and that's not fair. So that was how I originally reacted. and I think a lot of folks originally reacted that way. And then, you know, my phone started to ring and buzz nonstop today. And now I feel a little bit more confident that we're okay. That, you know, people are out there organizing. People are not going to let this, they're not going to stand idly by.
How so? What actions do you think people will take that make us okay or make you feel better?
There's already a press conference planned at 1 o'clock. I mean, that's amazing.
You're headed there right after
we
speak.
We're on our way. The ACLU is there. CARE is there. Council on American Islamic Relations, NERP, the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, the Muslim Empowerment Network. Elected officials are already going to be there. And every time I talk to somebody, they want to know where they can be. There is not a single person who has come up to me, and maybe it's my circle, but there isn't a single person who's come up to me and said, oh, yeah, that's how it should be. Everyone is offended by this. Everyone is upset by this. This is not what our country stands for. And that makes me feel confident going into tomorrow that this is, we have a history of doing horrific things to people of color, to immigrants, to refugees, but we also have a history of standing up and saying that wasn't okay and we're not going to do it again. And I don't believe the war is over. I think we're in the middle of it, and maybe we lost a little battle, but we're still in there.
Tom, your grandparents were U.S. citizens stripped of their land, homes, businesses. Your parents, your aunts and uncles sent to this camp, internment camp in Idaho. What is the connection? What are you expecting or fearing next to connect this, if you're making a connection between this travel ban and an internment of citizens? What connection are you making and watching for?
Well, I'm just, you know, looking at our country today, not only the travel ban that came today, but, you know, the family detention centers on the border. And, you know, as a historian looking back at what happened to Japanese Americans, you know, one of the clear findings from the government was that what causes these things, the underlying, you know, causes of these major actions are things like fear, you know, hatred or prejudice, and a failure of political leadership. And when you have that sort of mixture of those three things happening, you know, bad things happen. And so when I looked at, you know, what happened during World War II and the amount of war hysteria, you know, the racial prejudice against Japanese, as well as the failure of political leadership to, you know, really call out, you know, the fear and anger towards Japanese, I see those same factors happening today. So one, we see this on the southern border, and now we're seeing this again in our country today at the Supreme Court level in terms of Muslims.
What are you asking our listeners? What actions, concrete actions, are you taking, and what are you asking listeners to do?
So both of us are going to be at the press conference today. That is momentarily. And if you don't have to be at work, you should come join us. I would say get involved. Stop sitting.
How so?
Call CARE. Call the ACLU. Call NERP. Call the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. If you have language abilities, start volunteering. Get more engaged.
Is there anything that people in the Seattle area can do for people hoping to immigrate from those countries? There are waivers that we've heard about, visa waivers.
I mean, that's, yes, I'm sure there are many things. It's not something that I'm prepared to comment on right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tom, what action beyond this news conference and rally, what are you doing and what are you asking our listeners to do?
Yeah, something I think I mentioned this last time too, Bill. I think it's so important that in this and since then, it feels like things have become more and more uncivil in terms of our discussion. But for this to really change, I think we need to really reach out and talk to each other, not just within our comfort range of political beliefs, but to really go out there and start sharing. I think it's important for, communities of color in terms of things happening, to share their story as much as possible. I really call upon Japanese Americans to share what happened to their families so people understand the consequences, not just what happened to the war, but the decades and decades after and the trauma that that caused in the community. I mean, these are things that are real that people need to hear.
Sahara, have you thought about what you'd say to your now 5-month-old son?
I would say that we stood on the right side of history, that we didn't go down without a fight. We're still fighting.
What is that fight going to look like? What are you asking of people? Do you need a moment? Sorry. Okay. Well, I'll let you wrap us up, Tom, if you like. What gives you? We were talking about this before our microphones went on about the about fear and hope. What gives you hope? Well, that leads to action.
Sahir's emotions right now. What that really got me present to was the anguish and pain and memories that Japanese Americans experience and still feel to this day. And for you to know that people see you and hear you and support you, and how important that is for all of us to come together in these really dark moments of our country. And that as difficult as this is, I mean, in the darkest moments of the Japanese American community during World War II, there is the strength of resilience that emerges as long as we stay together. And I just want to, again, emphasize how much there are people here who support you during this very difficult time.
Tom Ikeda, Executive Director at Densho, and Sahar Fathi with One America Votes. Sahar, I'm sorry if I put you on the spot there, but thank you for coming in. And I know you're headed to this rally, and let's keep talking. Thank you both for this. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Right now, I'm sitting across from my coworker, Jeannie Yandel, who I've worked with off and on for what? 15 years?
15, 16 years,
yeah,
something like
yeah.
that.
Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
We've never, you and I have never talked about our salaries. It just didn't come up in our years of chit-chat.
Nope, never once.
Well, let's talk about money. Jeannie's the co-host of a new podcast from KUOW, along with her co-host, Eula Scott-Bino. Hi, Eula.
Hey, how are you?
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too.
You and I have never been co-workers.
But in a way. I feel like we're in the same building, so that counts as like we know the experience of parking.
Indeed. Okay. We have that in common. And this podcast is called Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, which you came out in the episode and you say, your workplace is sexist.
Yeah.
Even if it's, what did you say, even if it's not
even if it's not visible.
Not visible, and even if you work for yourself.
It's true.
Yeah, as
I mean,
you do.
I do. And I know that it's hard because one of the things as we talk about as women and as people, right, is pay, and we know that there are differences. And even working for myself, I have to figure out my rate, right? Yeah. And often my rate is something that it's hard to find because as a woman of color, I don't know where to start looking first.
Yeah. That's the topic of the first episode of the podcast is let's talk about the gender pay gap and other pay gaps, and let's talk about money. Why do we not talk about money in the workplace? We talk about a lot of stuff that's not just about our work.
Yeah. I mean, where do we start? Like, I was definitely told when I was a kid not to talk about money, right? You don't talk about money. You don't talk about politics. You don't talk about religion.
Yeah. I can remember asking my mom once, Mom, like, how much you make? And she was very upset with me for even asking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
She was so offended that I would even want to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same. Age and salary, not options for conversation in the house as well.
Yeah.
And also, it's a good thing to keep us all a little bit more hush-hush about how much we make. Because then if we found out how much we all might make, we might come together and decide that we're not getting paid enough, right?
Do you think that's more intentional on the part of employers? It's not just a cultural, you know, squeamishness?
Well, it's hard to say whether there's anybody sort of twisting their mustache out there saying, we're going to make sure nobody talks about their salary. But certainly the discomfort we have can be helpful, right? I mean, you know, you and I, Bill, work for a public agency, so our salary information is actually public. But
yes,
that's not the case for everybody. Like, there are companies here in Seattle that don't have to publish their salary data, which means that employees don't know what they make compared to their fellow employees unless they ask.
Right.
Yeah. Scary.
Why do you think it is so scary? Besides, like, we've said our parents discouraged it, but why is that so hard to get beyond?
I think because our parents are such big influences in all of our lives, right? Yeah. And they tell us things typically with that hold very much like all the weight, right? When your mom says something like, you don't talk about it, you think, oh, she knows what she's talking about, so I'm just going to follow suit. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to kind of be trying to rework that mindset that conversation I had with my mom was probably, you know, 15 years ago. And so now I'm finally thinking like, okay, I need to be saying how much I make. I need to be asking how much people make, because if I have no understanding, I have nowhere to build on.
Right. Yeah. And there's another episode where we go into the ideal worker and sort of the myth of the ideal worker. And one of the things about the ideal worker is we keep our work lives and our home lives separate. So when we have learned about talking about money, we learn how to do it in the home, right? We talk about home finances, bills,
sure,
stuff like that. But that's a separate sphere than work. So there's also this other weird wall erected because of the notion of the ideal worker, that we keep those two places separate.
And
even
how
though
does
totally
this,
not.
Right. How does this dynamic perpetuate the pay gap we started with?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. So the reason why it perpetuates the pay gap is because if we don't know what we're looking at, we can't narrow it down.
Right.
And so the more we don't bring up the fact that, like, my number is really 54 cents on a white man's dollar, because I'm not only just a black woman, but I'm a mother. Right.
Right.
And people who have children are usually looked down as being somehow less dedicated, even though they have more reason to make a paycheck. The oddity of that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's one part of it. But if we don't know where to start, I mean, you can look, you know, we look at this as a huge national problem, which it is, and there are policies to try and figure it out. But if we also just don't know what it looks like with the person next to us in the cubicle and why it's like that, how do you even make small changes within workplaces, right? Within companies. And, you know, so that's one of the ways it gets perpetuated. You can't even make small change because you don't really know what you're dealing with.
And because 54 is very different from 77.
It is.
Yes, it's not just a gender pay gap. There are pay gaps. Will you fill people in about that?
Yeah. Go for it, Jeannie.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we've reported this on KUOW, a woman makes 78 cents to a man's dollar or 80 cents to a man's dollar. But that's an average of a whole bunch of different gaps together. So, you know, before I had a daughter, I made, according to all of the research out there, 84 cents to a white man's dollar. That's significantly different than what Eula made based on what we know from national research, right? Eula made 63 cents.
Before a child.
So why aren't we talking about the people who make the least amount of money? Why aren't we solving those problems first? That's going to benefit me. That's going to benefit you. It's going to benefit everybody in the room if we close the biggest gaps first. But we don't talk about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk in the episode, did you say that black women overall make more money than black men? Did I get that right?
There was the white women do. I make more money than black men do.
Yes. Yep. Yes. Thank you. White women make more money than black men. So it's not necessarily across
That's
gender.
Right.
Multiple factors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Play. Yeah. When we talk about how, like, the challenge of if a black man makes less than a white woman, and then a black woman's 54 cents my 54 cents has to go a lot further.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we're uncomfortable talking about money, but if we don't, it's hard to make change.
Yes.
So how are you saying, what are my battle tactics? How are we shifting the culture?
Mm-hmm. Tactics are our favorite.
They really are.
Yeah. So one of the things that one of our guests told us, which I think blew both of our minds, is you can practice negotiating, which is another thing that is sort of ingrained in our culture, right? Like, we have to negotiate for salary. Eula has to negotiate for her freelance rates.
True.
So negotiating stinks. Nobody enjoys it. Some of us are socialized not to negotiate. But you can practice. You can practice on your cable company. You can practice on your cell phone company. You can practice with your credit card companies. Ask for a better interest rate, right? Ask for a better monthly rate. They could say no, but it's a pretty low stakes way to practice negotiating. So you're not just in a room with your boss being like, oh, God, how do I make this argument? How do I make this argument?
And I liked the question, am I getting the best rate?
Yes.
Because it's not even argument. That's a yes or no, mm-hmm, that if they're honest, starts you in a different mental place for the conversation you're about to have.
Yeah, yes. Totally.
Yes.
Another good one, I don't think this one made the show actually, was the idea of making a folder of your wins.
Oh my gosh.
Right? So when you're having real successes at work and you know that you're going to be having to negotiate and having to go into those conversations with your boss, instead of going in kind of blindly or, you know, with your own baggage of, did I do so great this last year? Throughout that year, making a little bit of a folder where you put all of these wins every time someone complimented your work, every time you got some kind of a little award. So that way, when you go into the next negotiations, you can back your number or your hopes and your dreams of pay with actual like markers of success.
Yes. Yeah. Did your documentation.
Did you say you were socialized not to do those things? What do you mean?
So there has been research that to indicate, for example, that if a job listing doesn't explicitly say salary is negotiable, men by and large will still negotiate. This was a massive study out of Harvard Business School. Women won't. It won't even occur to them to negotiate because that's not really a skill that, and I don't want to generalize, but many women don't sort of grow up knowing, I can just keep asking for what I want. I can just keep pushing for what I want.
Yeah, and challenging men, right?
Right, yeah. So, and that was just one piece of research pointing to the fact that, you know, some of us are better suited for asking what we want repeatedly, others of us less so, which also perpetuates this thing. So many things perpetuate it.
So if I'm an employer and I want to pay my workers... If I want to pay my workers as little as the workers will agree to, why would I advertise, please feel free to negotiate?
Right.
But
right.
You're kind of suggesting that employers do that.
Well, it's again, you know, so this is another sort of surprise thing that we've learned making this podcast, I guess, is that, you know, it's really hard to say that there's one person twirling their mustache who is evil, who is sort of plotting all of these things in a very conscious way. A lot of employers may not even be aware of this. You know, there are employers here in Seattle who recently decided not to ask new hires for their past salaries because they don't want to use that past salary information to decide what they should be paid now. This also perpetuates the pay gap. And it's not because before people were trying to be evil and pay people less. People just didn't, nobody realized it. But we have all of this social science research saying, oh, we've been making mistakes for years. We have to make some like big system changes here.
And there are benefits to people being like having more like transparent pay too, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
What are those studies? Because I feel like you know these on the dot.
I mean, you know, one of the benefits of having more transparent pay means that when you have conversations about what the budget looks like, you have employees who are more on board with what's happening because everything feels more transparent,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's just one benefit that can really help employers.
Jeannie Yandel and Eula Scott Bino are looking for your battle tactics, right? You're soliciting.
Yes.
For this podcast, KOW podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace. So someone wants to contact you right now. They're listening. What should they do?
Ooh, they can email us at btsw@kuow.org. They can hop on social media and use the handle BTSW podcast. Those are just two ways to get a hold of us.
And if you're listening and you're thinking like, maybe they're not talking about my work. We are.
Yes,
every
we
workplace
are.
Is sexist. We're sure of it.
Eula Scott Bino, Jeannie Yandel. The BTSW is for the new podcast, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, and you can suit up for that battle on the KOW app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to the both of you. Good to see you.
Thanks so much, Bill.
It's The Record on KOW. We'll be right back. In the future, maybe today, maybe a century from now, the ground will shake. Buildings will crumble, roads will crater, and a 60-foot wall of water will speed across the Pacific and crash into our coast. Yes, a big earthquake is coming. Eventually, the big earthquake. Are you ready? You could be, says Dr. Lucy Jones. She's the author of the new book, The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us. She spoke with us back in April, and yes, if her name sounds familiar, you may have seen her in a Jeopardy question.
Yeah, that's actually happened twice. I'm still
Still
can't quite believe it.
How was that? I know about one of them. What were the Jeopardy? I guess you were a Jeopardy answer.
I was a Jeopardy answer. There was one about the movie The Rock, with The Rock, the San Andreas movie.
Yes.
And it was something about Paul Giamatti. I can't even remember now what the question was.
I can quote it. Seismologist Lucy Jones found fault with this film, saying you can't predict quakes as Paul Giamatti's character does.
There you go.
Answer San Andreas.
The San Andreas. That movie was Yeah.
They played fast and loose.
It had some good messages about emergency response and how you plan. The science was non-existent.
Uh-huh. This is a scientist I'm talking to, a seismologist, and you write that natural disasters stem from the same forces that give our planet life. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, to live in this world, we need to have the carbon cycle. We need to have the water cycle. We need to have rain coming in and watering our plants. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, though, that also leads to occasional floods. Mm. We need to keep nutrients in the soil. One of the things the volcanoes give you are wonderful soils that are very good for producing crops. Unfortunately, they also occasionally erupt.
We have good farmland here partly because of that history, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Pacific Northwest is sort of archetypal natural hazards land. You've got these beautiful mountains, which give you landslides. You have the slush forest because of all the rain and therefore all the flooding. You have the tsunami and the earthquake and the volcano. I mean, we're really rather impressed and elsewhere in the world at how you bring it all together. And it is why it's so beautiful here.
Yes.
It's absolutely part and parcel of the whole thing. And so it's just that all of these systems that move things around the earth and make life possible have extremes. And anytime you have a river, you've also got floods. Anytime you have a volcano, you have eruptions. You know, and we've got to think of it. And I think the difference here is that I'm an earth scientist. So I can talk about 10,000 years as recent, and it is recent. It's normal, right?
Yes.
I think on a different time scale than most people do.
Yeah. How does your thoughtful perspective help me when the ground is shaking like crazy?
Well, it helps you understand that this is just a natural process and you could have done something. Maybe it doesn't help you if you haven't done it before. Beforehand, it can help you realize that it's worthwhile doing this stuff. But human beings don't want to go there. We're so afraid of the random out of the blue hit that we obsess about it. So when people think about the big earthquake coming, what are they thinking of? They're afraid of dying.
Yeah.
Right?
That's on my list of fears. Yeah.
But I mean, even in Pompeii, 90% of the victims made it out alive. Right?
Pompeii, this is about about the year zero, right?
Right. In Italy. 79, Vesuvius erupts.
Yeah.
The town's completely buried. The whole city leaves human knowledge for 1,500 years. But 90% of the victims still got out alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just probably not going to die.
Hmm.
What's really at risk is our societies. What sort of a city will Seattle be after that big earthquake comes through and the tsunami hits? And number one, we've done such economic damage to our buildings. You know, we have buildings we know will fall down. And I understand that you guys are debating whether or not to try and deal with the unreinforced.
For years, Dr. Jones, Seattle and Washington State, we've been debating and debating and debating.
And they will kill people when the earthquake hits. Absolute. No question about it.
The former King County Emergency Management Director says our buildings are so dangerous and have been for so long that when an earthquake kills people, everyone involved in not taking action should be charged with manslaughter.
That's an extreme way of looking at it, but yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is we know, and you are choosing not to do anything about it because you're so obsessed about that time. Is it today? Is it tomorrow? Is it 100 years? That becomes the only thing we think about.
I thought we were obsessed with money because isn't that a big part of it? We talk about mandating these seismic retrofits, but the question has been, who's going to pay for that?
The problem is it's an obsession with the short-term money. In the long run, you will save money by doing the retrofitting. There have been studies that show we save $6 for every dollar spent on retrofitting in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem. We aren't willing to give it that time. And that's where I'm saying the geologic perspective. I look at this and just can't understand it.
I see.
It's absolutely inevitable. One of the problems, I think, you know, when we talk about the earthquake, you'll hear, you know, the chance of it happening in the next 30 years is 10%, 15%, whatever it is for up here. And it sounds, you know, if you heard that there was a 15% chance of rain today and then it didn't happen, well, all right, the risk is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in Seattle. In Southern California, we're sure, okay, now it's over, right?
Yeah.
And we use that same words. The problem is it's not that we know anything about 30 years. We use 30-year probabilities because that's the length of most people's mortgages. And therefore, a time frame in which they're making financial decisions. What we know is the earthquake is absolutely 100% certain to happen as long as you give me enough time.
Well, yeah, but that's a pretty hugely important variable. I sleep well because of that variable.
yeah, but I wouldn't sleep well in an unreinforced masonry building.
Well, actually, in Seattle, I wonder how do you think we're how worried should we be about an earthquake in Seattle? Assuming I'm home, I'm not sleeping on an ocean beach.
It is in the lifetime of most of your younger listeners, it will be happening. Yeah. In their lifetime. You know, once or twice every 50 years, that's not that often compared to other things, but we can tell you what's going to happen because of it.
Are we talking about something much worse than the 2001 Nisqually quake? I remember. I was there. And it was, I got a crack in my wall and it shook me around. And
That was what I was talking about. It depends. What it's like, though, depends on where you are with respect to the earthquake. How close were you to where the earthquake happened? I mean, if you're right on top of it, it's going to be quite a bit worse than some distance away.
Right, right. I suppose I was about somewhere under an hour away from the center of
it. Then you were so far away that you really shouldn't be having any damage whatsoever. And if you do, that implies your building isn't in great shape.
You said that we're don't think of it as you're going to die, right?
Right.
Why is that? Why isn't it good to think, uh-oh, I'm going to die if I don't do all the right things?
Well, it's just, I'm a scientist. It may be successfully manipulating you, but it isn't true. You know, most people, in Southern California, we estimate 99.99% of people will live through our big earthquake. Now, you are far more likely here, as well as in LA, to be killed on the freeway. You're more likely to be murdered, quite a bit more likely to be murdered than you are to die in the earthquake.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, it's a wonderful part of American life. And the problem is, if we're focusing on that, we can't seem to focus on the money aspect. You really should be worried about being bankrupted by the earthquake. Because if you've now lost your house and the building where you're going to work is badly enough damaged that they won't let you in, and the water pipes are disrupted and the sewers are disrupted, how many people stay when they haven't had a shower in a month?
Yeah.
And then the city, what's at risk is not our lives, it's our society.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning that the cities will struggle to survive through this. You can look at San Francisco in 1906. It was many, many decades before it got back any of the standing that it had had before. I mean, in 1905, San Francisco was the New York of the West Coast, the only one that mattered.
Mm-hmm.
The decade after 1906 is the biggest growth decade in the history of Los Angeles. We were one-fifth the size of San Francisco before that earthquake, and we're now five times the size of San Francisco. And so there are fundamental shifts like that. Or think of Portugal. One of the stories in my book is of the Lisbon earthquake of 1755. When that earthquake happened, Portugal was a major colonial power. It had Brazil. It was very rich. It was set back enough by that basically they never recovered. And Portugal is not a significant city, in Europe, and it lost its colonial standing because of all of this.
Maybe they were punished for being colonizers.
Well, at the time, we definitely believed that it was God's wrath that was why the earthquakes were happening.
The book that you mentioned is called Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them, and the author is Dr. Lucy Jones. And we would have plenty of warning before a Mount Rainier eruption, right? I don't worry about that one.
Okay, so there's where you're focused on your life safety issues. Yes, you will probably have a warning. I do say probably. You remember Mount St. Helens in 1980. We had 3 months where it was obvious that there was undergoing unrest.
Steaming.
Right, and the magma was moving from deep in the earth to closer to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that unrest will just stop and you don't have the eruption. So we will have a warning, but we won't have a 100% certainty warning.
So we'll just figure,
it depends on how you respond. I mean, people were still living there near Mount St. Helens and died in that eruption because they didn't listen about leaving.
Mm. Hey, a listener named Josh here in the U District where you are right now wrote to us and asks, I'm wondering if the Space Needle is the safest place to be in Seattle during an earthquake. I don't know why the Space Needle would be the safest place.
I cannot imagine.
Maybe he thinks it'll sway, like the Earth will be freaking out underneath it, and it'll just wave a little bit.
There's a couple of things. One is that we need to remember that our...
Nothing's falling on top of you if you're in the Space Needle.
It was built before you had significant seismic building codes in Washington.
Okay.
And that's a major issue. Right? Your building is only as good as the building code in place when it was built and the degree to which it was enforced. And even our current code doesn't say, let's have a good building. It says, don't kill me. Mm. So if the building's a total financial loss, but you crawl out alive, that was a success.
That's a win.
That's a win. And there's where I worry about the economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because imagine now the new buildings in Seattle, maybe 10, 20% of them are so badly damaged you aren't allowed to use them. What's your economic outcome then?
Dr. Lucy Jones, you live in Southern California.
I do.
Earthquake country. So how woke are you?
I would rather
choose to stay there.
I choose to stay there. There's a few reasons, because just like everybody else, I have other factors that go into my decisions. I have a good job there. My family's, I'm a fourth generation Southern Californian. I like the sunshine. But also, I'd be, it's just not that big a risk to my life.
What's your house like? Do you have walls made entirely of plastic water bottles?
Oh, that's an idea. No, I have a 1948 house, but every time I've bought a house, I've brought in a foundation specialist to look at it and help me understand if there's anything we could do to make it safer.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a little extra work. I think we spent about $200 on this house, but it made it, got rid of a vulnerability.
You actually wrote that water bottles are a little overrated.
Well, I
didn't mean, you just in terms of you think that's going to help you out? There's other things you could.
Well, all right. I would not say don't get water bottles,
yeah,
because we are going to lose our water system.
Yeah.
And that's actually a really critical one. But if I had to choose between storing water and getting my house retrofitted, I'd get my house retrofitted.
Make the pipes flexible and strong and
well, that's,
keep the water.
I mean, this is one of the things that's happening in Los Angeles. I spent the year of 2014 in the mayor's office. And together we developed a set of plans for how to make us more seismic resilient. And it ended up passing all the things that required ordinances passed unanimously through city council. We got it through. One piece of it is an overhaul of the water system in Los Angeles. It's a very long-term effort because the water system is very expensive. But the city has made a commitment to seismic-resistant pipes, which is going to make that probably, if I only got one thing, that's what I'd want, because that's the economic future of the city after the earthquake happens.
We're talking with earth scientist, seismologist Dr. Lucy Jones. The mayor of L.A. said when the big one hits, people will be alive because of the work she has done to prepare. One thing about natural disasters, doctor, they're very localized. A Texas right. hurricane and a Philippines typhoon don't physically affect me. Will climate change be a disaster that actually unites us?
Hopefully, because I mean, climate change... number one, absolutely happening. Number two, it is increased heat in the atmosphere. Heat is energy. The atmosphere now has more energy to contribute to storms. The rate and intensity of our big storms are all going up. And so we are going to be seeing more damage from hurricanes, from tornadoes, from typhoons, from extreme storms, from atmospheric rivers. The rate of all of these are going up, and they're going to be affecting all of us. There's also another big change in the world, though, of globalization, right? We are much more interconnected than we used to be. Even, you know, whatever the economic system, we have the telecommunications. When the tsunami hit Japan, we all watched it in real time move over the Sendai Plain. Right? So we have a more visceral connection to people around the world. And that's the good part. It means that we are able to feel connected to the victims and have more empathy. And it helps us take our risks more seriously. Americans are much more concerned about tsunamis now because of what they saw happening in Japan and Sumatra. The bad side is we're also more economically and even physically connected. We have concentrated into cities. These cities are dependent on complex engineering systems. Systems fail where they're already weak, and anything less than the perfect system is a vulnerability. So I talked about the loss of water pipes or of sewers. You know, when that happened in 1906, in that earthquake in San Francisco, people built outhouses in their backyards and went on.
Mm-hmm.
We lose the sewer system now. It is a major public health crisis for a city. But our, and then the third piece is our economies are connected now, too. So that if we really wipe out the you know, chip production in Taiwan, it's going to be affecting the economy of anywhere, of Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach, all of the electronic high-tech companies, and we're all going to be struggling with that. So globalization is, as I think, better for human society. It's better for our ethical development, but it means that we are collectively more at risk from everybody's disasters.
She has written about disasters ethically, socially, economically, physically. She's an earth scientist, seismologist, Dr. Lucy Jones, author of the new book, Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. And the proper pronunciation, tsunami. Thank you for that.
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Jones, a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for writing this and coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We spoke to Dr. Jones in April here on KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in today. Our show is produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Allison Bruzek, and Jason Pagano, with our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow on the show, where is Barack Obama? New York Magazine is asking why, quote, the most popular American whose legacy is the primary target of Donald Trump has for now virtually disappeared from public life. I'll put that to former Obama advisor Ben Rhodes. His new book is The World as It Is, a memoir of the Obama White House. That's tomorrow.